Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Welcome to Progressive News Network, PNN, and this is not Rick Spezak tonight. This is Bob Abstin. I am a good friend of Rick's, and I appreciate his entrusting his show, Progressive News Network, to me tonight. Rick is off with his beloved, who has won a contest for her interior design skills. So I'll be sitting with you tonight, and we've got an interesting show. I won't spend a lot of time boring you with the details. We'll just jump right into it. And we'll be starting out the show. We'll be talking about Fukushima tonight. And we will be starting out the show with Dr. Lynn Ringenberg, who is going to talk about the nuclear crisis that the world confronts today. And without further ado.
Hello, Dr. Ringenberg.
Hello.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Good. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you great. Thanks.
Great. You bet.
First, again, I want to thank you for joining us. Your expertise in this arena is so important. So few Americans are appraised of this information, so I want to thank you and thank you for the work that you do to help people stay informed. What can you tell us about the latest? Oh, first, let me introduce you, Dr. Lynn Ringenberg of the Physicians for Social Responsibility. Doctor, thank you for coming.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for asking me. And let me clarify a couple things. I'm a pediatrician here in Florida for over 35 years, and that's what got me interested in this. I'm also the president of Physicians for Social Responsibility in Florida and sit on the Health and Radiation Committee for National PSR. So, you know, I'm not an expert in all aspects of this. I look at more of the health issues.
Uh-huh.
But there's just so much that the American people aren't hearing, and it's very disturbing to me that we're not getting the information out to people.
Well, let me make this little comment. From listening closely to the wonderful symposium held through the Caldecott Fukushima Symposium, one of the things that was mentioned is, absent the public information, we must all become health physicists. So thank you for your work to get the news out.
Well, I think we're going to have to. And, you know, that was a wonderful symposium. I actually couldn't attend, and I haven't been through all of it yet, but I'm kind of making my way when I have time through it. And I just, you know, the thing that I guess is so hard to get out to people to understand, because it's hard for me to understand, and I've spent my life in science and medicine, but, you know, radiation, it's silent, it's invisible. So it doesn't, when it enters your body, it doesn't say, hey, something's going on. And it's a long-term chronic condition and eventually a killer. I mean, it's, and somehow we have to get that message out about radiation.
Well, I think, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just think that somehow we're not reaching people. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of business interests and a lot of money going into, I think, keeping us from reaching people like we should in this country. I mean, the Fukushima disaster is far from over. And it's really very frightening that the Unit 4 is gradually, and this came out in the Caldecott Symposium, but it's gradually sinking, and that entire structure is very likely to collapse. And there's, you know, it's like, it's hard again to imagine. There's like 1,500 spent nuclear fuel rods that have over 37 million curies of deadly radiation, and it would, if this collapses and this is released, it really would make much of the world completely uninhabitable. I mean, it's kind of hard, it almost seems like sci-fi, you know, it's kind of hard to understand this and comprehend it. But there are folks like Helen Caldicott and others that have spent their lives, their academic, scientific, and medical lives studying this, and so the science is there. And so I think there's a lot of alarm in with a lot of us that if that reactor truly sinks and there's an explosion or a fire or another big earthquake or some other natural disaster there. Apparently they're having little earthquakes all the time.
Yeah,
Japan
6.
Has more earthquakes than anybody else in the world. And so if they should have another one and that structure continues to collapse, I mean, it would be a catastrophic meltdown.
Well, I want to ask you a couple questions related to what I learned in the symposium. I'm one of those rare individuals who I got interested in atomic power when I was very, very young. For my 8th birthday, I was given a book on nuclear power, and of course it was a science book for children. But I got very intrigued by it, very intrigued at the subatomic particles, and I've been reading about this ever since. And when the Three Mile Island incident came along, I immersed myself. I was able to take very close notes and recorded the Three Mile Island hearings. And since I was in college at the time, I thought it was important that people, again, get exposed to the actual information, not merely the propaganda. So I called the NRC and asked them to send a health physicist to come and lecture at the college. And, of course, they begged off. They said, well, we have public relations people for that. And I said, well, I understand that, and I understand that that's the typical reaction. But what I had hoped to accomplish, I said, was, you know, since those of us who work in the sciences know that very rarely does good scientific information come unimpeded through the press. So I said, here was a chance. We want to have a HP come out and talk. And long story short, that we actually did get a health physicist who not only, it turned out, worked at the Turkey Point plant in South Dade, but he also was the senior NRC health physicist at Three Mile Island. So he had a lot of very interesting things to say, and so I bring some small expertise to this this challenge. But one of the things I want to mention to you was, in addition to that great comment that we're all health physicists now, was a comment that one of the investigators, her name escapes me right now, she mentioned that increasingly every time there's an incident, what the nuclear regulatory industry tends to do is either A, stop monitoring, which is what I understand they did off the coast of California,
right.
Or
right.
B, raise up the amount of exposure that people can have.
Right.
And
right. Like
that doesn't sound like science.
Right?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just said like they did in Japan right after the incident. They raised it up to a level of 20 and then immediately lowered it down. But a lot of kids especially were exposed at that higher level, saying that was safe. But anyway, I'm sorry. I kind of interrupted.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I'm happy when you react like that. Sure. Another point that they made, which again I've never heard anyone make, but of course is so clear and obvious if you think about it. They said those magical radius circles that are drawn around nuclear plants. that in fact in the real world, winds do not stop at 10 miles, nor do they radiate in an equal measure in all directions, so that then when you start thinking about prevailing winds, it really provides a much different picture of exposure. Another point that was made that I thought was terribly, terribly shocking was they were saying that in the context of exposure, when not only was there a much greater level of exposure, but when people are living subsistence or they're living off the sea, and you've got increasing levels of radioactive water leaking into the sea, there is no real membrane between the plants at Fukushima and the Pacific. Here you've got people who've been living off the sea, both fish and seaweed. This is going to be bioaccumulating. Because, it, you know, And the other point that they made about the bioaccumulation is, you know, we tend to think about, if people think about it at all, well, you know, there's that, oh, it's just similar to your annual ambient body exposure to radiation. But what the point they made was that exposure inside, when you ingest radioactive material, is very, very different than external body radiation.
All excellent points, and absolutely right. And I think things that, I mean, the information has been out there for a long time, but again, it's just not getting to people the way it should, I don't believe. I'm not sure what the answer is, except a total campaign in our country. I mean, I think the leadership needs to come from the top. I think during the, I've heard this a couple times, that what we need is like a Marshall plan, you know, like a for energy in this country, for safe energy in this country, a Marshall Plan like they did in Europe during the war, after the war. You know, I don't know, nobody knows when it's going to be irreversible. I mean, some of the damage that's being done to our bodies and the planet. You know, there is no safe. I mean, another thing I think we need to continue to hammer home is there is no safe level of radiation exposure. So even background, I mean, the beauty of our bodies are we can repair a lot of things that happen to us, so some of that background radiation exposure and probably an X-ray or so, or, you know, we can repair some of that. Our DNA has the ability to do that. But after it continues to accumulate and accumulate and accumulate, it can't repair it anymore, and that's what leads to cancer. And, you know, cancer takes maybe 5 to 70 years. And people are asking me now, you know, it seems that we're having, you know, we have a cancer epidemic. Almost everyone you talk to, somebody has cancer. Well, it's hard to really link that to anything specific, but, you know, this is when we'd see it. You know, look at the nuclear testing that was done back in the 50s, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and some of these other things, and these nuclear Chernobyl, and now Fukushima, and Three Mile, and some of the other accidents that have happened that weren't meltdowns, but radiation releases, and plants normally release radiation, and so these things are cumulative over time, and I think, personally, I think, and some other doctors that I work with think that that's contributing to this increase in cancer that we're seeing.
Absolutely. There's a story from, I think it comes out of Canada, Yahoo News, that's referring to a study from Radiation and Public Health Project found that babies born in Western United States, as well as other Pacific countries shortly after Fukushima, may be at greater risk for congenital hyperthyroidism.
That's right.
And it talks about babies born in places like Hawaii, Alaska, California, Oregon, Washington. And, you know, although there was there were some immediate monitoring right after the event, this monitoring has all but disappeared. Another point that you made during your last comment was very important, and I think it's very little understood, that while there's this, you know, so much standard background radiation is perfectly tolerable. The point that one of the other speakers made was that while that's true in the most general of senses, that's based on studies that were done of healthy 20-year-old men soldiers march through an area briefly for a brief exposure period. It was not extended. It wasn't elderly people or young people. And they said that there's actually a sex bias in radiation damage, that women and children, for a variety of reasons, tend to be more affected by radiation than men seem to be.
Absolutely. And you know, that standard man, that has been, many organizations, including PSR, have fought to change that. And the standard man is a 70-kilogram, 30-year-old white male in excellent health. And so that's the what they say is the safe dose for that standard person. And, you know, that's not the safe dose. I mean, there is no safe dose, but and women are, they have just some recent studies have found that women are more susceptible to radiation exposure and the cancers, and children, and especially fetuses, babies in utero, whose cells are just rapidly turning over, like thousands and thousands of cellular turnovers. I mean, these babies' DNA is really being exposed to radiation. And, you know, the results are devastating. Congenital malformations, and we're seeing more of that now in Chernobyl. I mean, the pictures are just frightening of what's going on over there. Learning disabilities, mental retardation, microcephaly, small heads that don't develop as well. I mean, all these things happen to babies in utero and young children. So, you know, and what's you know, obviously from PSR's standpoint, we don't need nuclear power plants. We don't need nuclear bombs. We don't need nuclear radiation. So we need to shut all this down.
One of the other things that I thought was just terribly devastating information, I think it was a Dr. Yablonsky from the Russian Academy
who
was talking about the fact that when Europe has been compiling data on genetic anomalies, they were totally ignoring Russia and the Ukraine. And we're only compiling their data in Europe, and it was only recently through extensive lobbying that they began to include that information. And then further, that one of the things that you don't typically consider, and obviously it's just terrible, is the fact that the folks who live near the Chernobyl plant are by and large agriculture-based, and here they are, the soil is not taking up the radiation. There's no clay in it, so it comes right into the plants. They're eating potatoes, and they're using the plant refuse to burn for their fires. So,
right. So
and it keeps accumulating and accumulating and accumulating, so they're breathing the smoke that's got radiation in it. They're eating the plants that have radiation in it, which is just increasingly accumulating in the soil, and it's not going away. So that plus alcohol's impact on genetics, it's just wreaking a terrible, terrible impact there.
It absolutely is. And I mean, we're seeing some of the same thing in Fukushima, but Fukushima's not that old yet. But
right.
I mean, just looking at, they did a study, I think it was last year, that looked at about a little under 40,000 kids, and, you know, 35% of them had thyroid cysts or nodules. You don't normally find that in children. And, you know, will these go on to become cancer of the thyroid? You know, many of them probably will, and other cancers. And that's just, you know, a few years after Fukushima.
And,
so
of course,
it is, yeah.
They can't scrub the soil. That's impossible, and it turns out
you can't filter the ocean.
That's for sure.
The ocean, right?
And I'm sure you've heard, as I have, to great dismay, that there's exacerbated by corruption. A lot of the cleanup is not really actual cleanup; it's just moving the pile from point A to point B, and worse, putting radioactive material in the rivers to expand the contaminated material and area.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what's so frightening. You know, the misinformation, the outright lies. And I know you've watched the Caldecott Symposium, the two folks from Japan that spoke. I mean, you know, there was obviously things that weren't told right, but they were outright lies, or just people just didn't know at the time. But I just think now we need to get this information out honestly to people. I'm not sure who can do it. I'm not,
Well, you know,
government.
unfortunately, the economic power, which controls so much of mass media in this country and the world, is all behind the nuclear power industry, is supported by the nuclear power industry. And then I think when you add that, plus the fact that a lot of people live their lives in an almost science-free zone. They leave science to experts, they leave medicine to experts, they don't take any responsibility for understanding the world that they live in.
You're right.
That kind of mentality is not good in the long run, that's for sure.
Well, you know, you don't want to, scare people too much, but I tell you, it really is scary. When I listen to these, you know, I've not been doing this many years compared to, you know, Dr. Caldecott's been doing it for 40 years.
Uh-huh.
Many of the folks that spoke there have spent their lives studying this, and I mean, they're really frightened about what's going to happen if we don't, you know, get this right. You know, and you don't hear people talking about it. I mean, I think a Marshall Plan would be great. You know, President Obama talked about mapping the brain. You know, we went to the moon on a decade challenge. We mapped the human genome, and now he wants to map the human brain, which I think is wonderful. But what about, you know, let's do a Marshall Plan for safe energy in this country? I'm just not hearing enough about the other forms of safe energy, you know, wind, solar, wave action, things like this. We're not hearing it, you know, enough of it at least. So we have lots to do in this country, and you know, we have a lot of the same reactors in our country. The Mark I GE reactor that was U.S. built, that
right.
was Fukushima Daiichi. So we have, I think, 22 or 24 plants in the U.S. that have this Mark I reactor. And these are old. A lot of our reactors in this country are 40 years or older. So something very likely could happen here.
Well, Dr. Ringenberg, you know, one of the things that, and I say this with the blackest of humor, one of the phrases that our media falls back on over and over is no imminent threat. There's no imminent threat. So the leaking of those Hanford storage areas, although it's going to leak into the Columbia River, there's no imminent threat. No one's going to fall over dead tomorrow. And I know when I was promoting and trying to get the stories out about Three Mile Island and about the dangers in our local reactors here, the question I kept getting asked by news directors was, well, is anyone going to die tomorrow? And I said, that is so not the right question. That is not the right question.
So naive. Well, and some, you know... Some did die immediately. I mean, obviously, some of those workers in Fukushima are dead.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a legacy we're leaving. And, you know, which brings me back to Crystal River. I mean, you know, so they closed down the Crystal River nuclear plant. That's wonderful. And now they have all that spent nuclear fuel sitting over there in cooling ponds. And so what is Duke going to do? They're going to leave it there for 60 years to cool off. 60 years, okay? They'll all be dead, right? And then they're going to leave it to the kids today that are, you know, 10, whatever. It's just mind-boggling to me. You know, this stuff needs to be put in, well, PSR recommends, as do many, into hardened, you know, construction sites, concrete hardened. A word for it, I'm blocking on it right now. Hawks.
Sure.
But you know, and yet they're just going to let it sit there. And that's the other thing that's really frightening is all the nuclear waste that we have. And this stuff really is susceptible. I mean, to fire, to an accident. We have, and I'm just going to look it up here because I had to look it up. A startling fact that we have approximately 72,000 tons. Still stored of nuclear waste, highly reactive. This stuff isn't, and that's the other thing that's, I guess, hard for folks to comprehend is, you know, once it's used in the reactor and it moves out to these cooling ponds, it doesn't lose its reactivity, and it stays reactive for hundreds of thousands of years. It doesn't turn off in 60 years, you know? And so 75% of all the spent fuel in this country is sitting poorly protected, highly vulnerable to a terrorist, to a fire, to something else, a severe natural disaster, Hurricane Andrew, and all these cooling pools are at full capacity. And so, you know, we really need to look at our nuclear waste in this country, not just from nuclear power plants, but from some of the arms, you know, like Hanford.
Sure. Well, one of the questions that I kept asking to everyone, I thought... both at the FPNL as well as the NRC that I spoke to, was how is this viable economically when you haven't yet solved the waste dilemma? And it only needs to be cared for, what's the half-life, 30,000 years? Since we haven't managed a cultural civilization that lasted more than a few hundred, how can you promise me anything about 5,000, 10,000, or 20,000 years, much less 30 or 50. It's just not economically viable. And without the insurance that the public underwrites and this incredible, ludicrous plan the state of Florida has accepted, that we can pay for these plants whether they build them or not? How would you like to be paid to be a doctor whether you practice or not? I think that's a grand idea. Is that part of that look to the future?
and I don't have to give back the $100 million or $150 million
that's right.
that you gave me.
That's
love
right.
It. Well, you know, but why are we hearing, people ought to be, you know, they ought to be streaming to Tallahassee, banging on doors and banging on their legislature's doors. And, I mean, they're just not. They're paying the money. They're paying the money. I mean, it's just, but you know, I guess then the flip side is, you know, what's the alternative? I mean, if we shut them all down tomorrow, we can't do that. But we can gradually phase them out and get, we have the technology now to the wind and solar and maybe efficiency, what, 38%?
Yeah.
And you know, you being inefficient, you know.
You mentioned a Marshall Plan. Why can't we have some of the, well, and just take FPNL for example, $14 billion in profit, and they can't invest in a Marshall Plan of solution to get rid of nuclear waste or to deal with it successfully. There's
sure
there's no money in that industry to invest in that solution. They're basically drop that stinking dangerous radiation refuse on our doorstep.
I know. Yeah, it's just, it's amazing. Well, I just think we're all gonna, like you said. I mean, we're all just gonna have to continue the fight. But all of us have to. I think if, you know, it can't just be a Helen Caldicott or a few here and there. I think the country, the grassroots, the people of this country are gonna have to demand change. I mean, we can do it, but. I think that, again, folks are kind of afraid of it maybe or don't understand it. So somehow we have to make it understandable to everybody. But this really isn't safe. It's not green either. You know, it's not green. It's not safe.
No.
Nuclear power plants.
Well, just to give you an idea of what I ran into when I wanted to simply invite an HP to come to our college to speak, the first thing that they asked me was, okay, you want an HP, give us your name, phone number, social security number, the company you work at, your employer's home number. They strictly tried to intimidate me into not making a simple request of having a scientist come out and speak.
I know, isn't, yeah.
And unfortunately for them, or fortunately for the college community, I toughed it out, gave them the information, didn't worry about what fragments of privacy we still have, and I asked. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was, FPNL, to try to balance, I guess, the terrible truth of the HP coming to the college, they invited my class to come to the plant and get a tour. And the person who they sent around with us, you know, to give us the information about the plant, he made a statement right at the beginning. He said, you know, all these green environmentalist types, they're trying to scare you about nuclear power. He said, well, I'll tell you right now, you could eat a cube of plutonium and you'd never feel a thing.
Oh, yeah, right. Go right ahead. We'll watch you. Go right ahead. Well, you know, the other thing that is kind of, it's all linked together, but, you know, when you look at climate change and you know, that's going to influence a lot of what happens to some of these nuclear power plants. It was just, I think, a few years back that 9 U.S. and 7 Canadian nuclear power plants had to go off the grid because of the heat was triggering so much overuse of electricity, and they couldn't keep up the cooling of, you know, of
mm-hmm.
everything that they
mm-hmm.
had to do. Anyway, they had to go off the grid. And as, you know, as climate change worsens, I think we're going to see that more often. And nuclear power plants on rivers with diminishing water.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these things are all kind of tied in together.
So, you know, looking 5 years and 10 years down the road, when Japan is largely quarantined, you know, you have to wonder, what is it that's going to happen for people to take notice, for them to take the time out of their lives and say, we have to put an end to this? Can you guess what that milestone is, what that terrible, terrible milestone is?
I hate to even think about it. I mean, you know, for the world, it has to happen to the world. I thought Fukushima was enough, but, you know, for the U.S., we're going to have a similar, you know, whether it's Turkey Point or New York. our own disaster, although we've had, you know, we've had a couple mild ones. I don't know. I really don't.
Well, we can be sure there won't be journalists allowed to fly over.
No, I don't know. And, you know, they're kind of lost my train of thought what I was going to say. But the one other thing that PSR did, and I don't have the reference right in front of me, but they looked at over the last 10 years from 2001 to 2011, and they looked at all the wind power that's in the U.S. already, and there is quite a bit of wind power. But that right now it's producing as much electricity as 7 nuclear power plants.
No kidding.
With each that has 2 reactors. So that's, you know, 14 reactors. And these wind turbines are producing enough electricity. So, I mean, I think it's there, but I think there are those that don't want it to happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There are those that don't want solar and wind to be successful and be our primary form of electricity.
Well, solar power might just end up being too cheap to meter, like the old slogan used to say, huh?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, Dr. Ringenberg, thank you so much for coming on. And anytime you'd like to come on and chat about these matters, honestly, if I did nothing but a show on nuclear power, it wouldn't be enough. So please help us get people informed.
Well, I would be happy to, or find people a little more knowledgeable than even I am.
Sure,
and,
that's fine.
I have you quickly, if I could just mention, I also would like, I think, a topic on fracking that's going on in Florida that's being proposed in Monroe, Dade, and Collier counties. And there's a bill before the legislators in Tallahassee.
Good God.
Talked about, and I could send you some info if you'd like to read.
Oh, please, please do, please do.
Because I just found out about it myself, and the bill is bad, and I can connect you with a journalist that you might want to talk with.
Certainly. I guess there's not enough threats to our water supply yet, huh?
Pardon me?
I said, I guess there's just not enough threats to our water supply yet.
There just isn't, you know, so now they want to frack, you know, I just... Jeez. So I have your email, right? Yeah.
You sure do.
Send it to that one?
Yep.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you again, Doctor. I really appreciate your work. And come back again, okay?
You betcha. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, third speaker is going to be Kevin Camps, and he's going to talk about 70 years of radioactive risks in Japan and the United States.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks so much to Helen and Molly for this event. It's a real honor to speak here. Yep, and apologies if I rush through, especially slides that echo what others have previously presented. But I've got a lot of ground to cover, as you can see from the title. So I found this image really striking. This is an image from Hiroshima after the bombing, actually, but I just found it so remarkably similar to the post-tsunami scenes that we all remember from 2 years ago. And of course, the comment has been made that even by the likes of the Prime Minister of Japan at the time, that the events of March 11th, 2011 are similar in magnitude and importance as things like the Hiroshima atomic bombing to the Japanese nation. So this is a view of Fukushima Daiichi before the catastrophe began, and I was invited on a speaking tour of Japan in August of 2010, 7 months before the catastrophe, and I stood on a bluff over the Pacific that looked down on Fukushima Daiichi. My first stop was Okuma and Futaba on the speaking tour. So 3.5 miles to the north, I could see the 6 reactors like this. And 3.5 miles to the south, from where I stood, I could see the Daini nuclear power plant with 4 reactors. And it's little known, but a single off-site power line is what saved Daini, more operating reactors than at Daiichi, from a similar catastrophe. Several off-site power lines were lost to the earthquake. The emergency diesel generators were lost to the tsunami. And that was the kind of scenario that Prime Minister Kan, his, at the time, Chief Cabinet Secretary Adano, admitted to the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation, and the headlines came out on the first anniversary of the Fukushima catastrophe. They feared a demonic chain reaction of atomic reactor meltdowns and pool fires. Six reactors, well, three operating at Daiichi, but seven pools at Daiichi. Four operating reactors at Daini and four pools. One reactor and one pool at Tokai, closer to Tokyo. And that's where the headlines came from about the possibility of having to evacuate Tokyo if that worst-case scenario had played out. 30 million people. But something that the filmmaker Kurosawa envisioned in his film Dreams in 1990 in the part called Mount Fuji in Red, atomic reactors exploding behind Mount Fuji as seen from Tokyo. So here are the explosions at the Unit 1 and the Unit 3. And the aftermath in mid-March of 2011. But it's not the first time, and I should mention that the reactors, of course, are General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors, so there's an instant tie between this Japanese catastrophe and U.S. involvement. But, of course, our nuclear involvement, so to speak, goes back 70 years. And we just held a conference in Chicago to mark the 70th year since Enrico Fermi fired up the first atomic reactor in the world, the Chicago Pile 1, as part of the Manhattan Project, the race for the bomb. So you can see an image, an artist rendition of the pile there. This is Enrico Fermi. And the title of the conference was A Mountain of Radioactive Waste 70 Years High. So, of course, this was all about the bomb. And these are images of the mushroom clouds at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so the radioactive risks began with the bomb project. And I should have mentioned that Enrico Fermi took a calculated risk, or maybe it was an uncalculated risk, at the University of Chicago. The original plan was to build that prototype reactor some 20 miles, 30 miles outside of town, where argon is now located. And there was no time. They couldn't do it in time, so they decided to just do it at the University of Chicago. They didn't even inform the president of the university. They're doing this on the edge of downtown Chicago, and Fermi convinced his higher-ups that probably it would be okay. But some of his graduate students were assigned the task of what they called the suicide squad, and this was to pour a chemical solution onto the pile if something went wrong. There was another individual called the safety control rod Axeman, who literally, with his axe, would chop a rope that was over a pulley and drop the control rod into the out-of-control reactor. And that term, scram, still sticks in the nuclear power industry. But as we saw at Fukushima Daiichi, you can scram a reactor when a 9.0 earthquake strikes, but the decay heat is enough to melt it down if you can't cool the cores. So again, with the history, we see Oppenheimer and Groves at the Trinity blast site. This was the precursor to the Nagasaki plutonium bomb and the aftermath of that shown. They didn't have to test the uranium bomb. It was sure to work, so they didn't test it. But, you know, as has been mentioned by Dr. Fairley and Mary Olson, the fallout from the Cold War, atomic bomb tests and hydrogen bomb tests. In this next section, Brian Victoria is right in the front row, so I owe a debt of gratitude to Professor Victoria because I learned history coming to Antioch University Midwest last Earth Day last year that I hadn't known about the early U.S. involvement in the Japanese nuclear power industry. So, atomic weapons testing in the Pacific. In mid-March of 2011, I happened to catch one of the episodes of CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, and it was about Fukushima that day, and they show these images on the right of the USS Ronald Reagan crew swabbing the decks in radiation protection gear because of being blanketed from Fukushima, and it just harkened back to these images from as early as 1946, and granted, that's a photo op. You can see the sailors are smiling, but they bore the brunt of that health damage over the years and decades after that. They are the atomic veterans. The atom bomb testing going on in the Pacific, a Cold War arms race with the Soviets well underway, and President Eisenhower gives a speech called Atoms for Peace at the United Nations in the early 1950s. And Arjun Makhijani at IEER has written just an incredible book, if you haven't read it. It's called The Nuclear Power Deception. It came out in 1999, and I learned a lot about the propaganda machine, which was Atoms for Peace. Because uranium mining and milling and processing and enrichment all had to be expanded for this arms race we were in with the Soviets. But how to sell that to the American people? Well, Atoms for Peace. It put a smiley face facade on this major expansion of all things nuclear. And remember, this is the early 1950s. The first so-called civilian atomic reactor was not fired up in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, under the direction of the head of the nuclear navy. So it's a civilian project, but it's a nuclear submarine reactor built on land just to get it going. A lot, or even most, or even all of the uranium in this country is being milled, being mined and milled and processed and enriched, was feeding the arms race for not years, but decades, until the commercial industry started to really show up in the 1970s, and then the uranium supply started to shift over somewhat to fuel those reactors. So this, again, the history that I learned from Brian Victoria. Castle Bravo was a series of hydrogen bomb tests that the United States carried out at places like Bikini. And on March 1st of 1954, the Bravo test got a little out of control. Edward Teller was involved in designing this bomb, as were other scientists, and they miscalculated the yield of this explosion. They expected a 5-megaton blast, and they got more like a 15-megaton blast. And it still is the worst radiological contamination incident in the history of U.S. nuclear weapons testing. And this Japanese tuna fishing boat, the Lucky Dragon number 5, was unfortunately not very far away. You can see in the map on the right there, the blast, Bikini marked by a B, the Lucky Dragon marked by the F. They were outside of the zone that the United States had declared off limits. But then later they redrew the danger zone, and they were well within that danger zone. And over time, half of the crew of 23 died of their radiation exposures. One of the deaths occurred pretty quickly, within a matter of months. And it led to an anti-nuclear groundswell in Japan, including a petition drive with many tens of millions of signatures against atomic bomb tests and against hydrogen bomb tests. And 1 million signatures alone from Hiroshima area. And the United States became very worried because there was this large groundswell of opposition to the nuclear energy establishment. And there were fears that even the Soviet Union or China could take advantage of this situation in the competition for loyalties after World War II. So again, the juxtaposition of images old and new. So on the left, officials from the city of Tokyo testing the tuna from the Lucky Dragon and finding severe contamination. But like Cindy talked about, some of that tuna had already been sold, had already been consumed before it was quarantined. And then on the right, this is actually an image from Thailand, not from Japan, but also dealing with the contamination of seafood post-Fukushima. And this was brand new to me that I learned from my visit to Antioch. So a part of the United States response to try to shore up Atoms for Peace was to actually deploy the Central Intelligence Agency to Japan. And this individual on the left is Louis Strauss, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission. And the Atomic Energy Commission took a lead role in downplaying the significance of the food contamination in Japan. And this individual on the right, Shiriki, fascinating story compared to Citizen Kane of Japan, a media mogul who controlled one of the largest newspapers, one of the largest television stations in Japan, had higher ambitions for political office, was a founder of the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, and in 2006 it was documented that he was working with the Central Intelligence Agency under a couple code names. And one of his assignments was to sell nuclear power to the Japanese people, and he did it with a passion. And so the infamous nuclear village was born, and this image is just one example. The speaker from the investigation by the Japanese parliament showed other images of the propaganda used. This is Plutonium Boy, and of course these are geared for children. And so exhibits were shown across the country just as they were here in the United States, traveling exhibits. And I, during my time in Japan in 2010, I went to one of these kind of Disneyland-like experiences at a nuclear power plant, which are really geared for young children. And one of the first companies to take advantage of the situation was a company that Mr. Shiriki worked with, and that was General Dynamics, that got in early on the nuclear business in Japan. But General Electric was not too far behind. So here's, you know, a grand total of about 140 atomic reactors in the U.S. 104 are still operating, but you got to take off Crystal River, Florida, 103 now. Take off Kewaunee, Wisconsin, 102. Sorry that Canada's not on the map because there are, you know, 20-plus reactors in Canada, but take off Jeanne 2 in Quebec. So there are dominoes on the brink of tipping over, and we need to shut them down before they melt down. This is Atomic Japan, third only to the United States, and then France with 58 reactors, Japan with 54, plus Manju, the fast breeder reactor. One of the places in Japan, Fukui Prefecture, a remarkable number of reactors, more than a dozen, along a short stretch of coastline. And what I want to do for the next section of the talk is just go through the parallels between U.S. and Japanese nuclear history in terms of accidents, incidents. They're remarkably parallel. And what I took was just an arbitrary list. The Associated Press, shortly after the beginning of the Fukushima catastrophe, put a list of, you know, a short list of 10 or so Japanese nuclear accidents that had already occurred before Fukushima. So I took that list, because it could be much longer, and I compared it to ones here in North America. So you see on the left, Suruga nuclear power plant, but you see on the right, the Bruce nuclear power plant in Ontario. This is worker overexposures. So in 1981, 300 workers were exposed to excessive levels of radiation after a fuel rod ruptured at Suruga. And it reminded me of an incident in Michigan at Big Rock Point, an experimental atomic reactor, where a MOX fuel rod was broken in the 1970s and 700,000 curies of radioactivity were released. But Bruce is also on the Great Lakes in Canada. And just recently, in 2009, there was an exposure of hundreds of workers to alpha particle radiation when they were grinding through contaminated pipes. They had no respiratory protection on. And before moving on from the Bruce slide, I just wanted to mention that this is one of the biggest nuclear power plants, certainly in North America. It's the biggest, and even in the world. There's a total of 9 reactors on this site. They're even proposing a low and intermediate level radioactive waste dump for all of Ontario's 20 reactors worth of waste, a burial site, 400 yards from the water of Lake Huron. But there are a half dozen communities, mostly populated by Bruce workers, that want to be the high-level radioactive waste dump for all of Canada. And the Great Lakes is 20% of the world's surface fresh water, drinking water supply for 40 million people in North America. So this next parallel is sodium fires. And you see Manju and Fukui Prefecture suffered a bad sodium fire in 1995. Videotape footage of the damage was concealed for a time and then later got released. But Fermi Unit 1 in Monroe County, Michigan, suffered a sodium fire, suffered tritium leaks in 2008. And what's remarkable about that is it had permanently shut down in 1972. These were decommissioning accidents at Fermi 1. Fermi 1 was made famous or infamous by an October 5th, 1966 partial meltdown of the reactor core, captured in the book We Almost Lost Detroit. So talk about a cover-up. That was a 10-year cover-up of a partial meltdown in Michigan until John Fuller wrote this book. The next parallels, reprocessing plant fires and explosions. Now this is a lesser-known accident at Tokai Mura in Japan. March 11, 1997, ironically the same date as the later Fukushima catastrophe. And 40 workers were exposed to radiation in this reprocessing. Yeah, I got a problem because I can't see my notes on the screen. So the parallel in the United States is right here in the state of New York at West Valley near Buffalo, a commercial reprocessing facility that operated from 1966 to 1972. But they had so many fires and leaks and worker overexposures at West Valley that they only did 1 year's worth of reprocessing throughput. They also did military reprocessing at that site. And the cleanup bill at West Valley is between $10 and $27 billion. And it's not even hardly begun. And if they do not clean that site up, it is going to erode into Lakes Erie and Ontario over time. So it has to be cleaned up. So the more infamous nuclear disaster at Tokai Mura was the inadvertent criticality of 1999. Two workers died from their radiation exposures. And another inadvertent criticality took place in 1999, but again, the truth was covered up for 8 years, and it wasn't known that there had been a 30-minute, I believe, criticality in the reactor core. Sorry, 15 minutes. And a similar thing had happened at Fermi Unit 2, which I'll show on this slide. Fermi 2, which is the biggest General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor in the world, same design as Fukushima Daiichi, only as big as Units 1 and 2 at Fukushima Daiichi put together. They had an inadvertent criticality in 1985, and the watchdog, Michael Keegan with Dumb Waste Michigan, outed it, and it kept that reactor shut down for 3 years because they didn't have a permit to run the reactor. They just did it accidentally. Luckily, no one was hurt. So the safety cover-ups continued. Tokyo Electric Power Company, the book about Tokyo Electric is called Dark Empire. So it starts to capture their behavior. So in 2000, three TEPCO executives were forced to resign after the revelation that in 1989, the company had ordered an employee to edit out footage showing cracks in nuclear plant steam pipes in video that was shown to regulators. Of course, they eventually were allowed to restart their reactors. And there was another cover-up in Japan that was outed by the Japanese anti-nuclear movement. Eileen Miyoko-Smith at Green Action told me this story. The British Nuclear Fuel Limited mocks fuel supply with falsified quality assurance figures, that it took tremendous efforts to document this, but they did, that those were falsified figures. They simply photocopied the results of earlier batches, so to speak, cut and paste, which caused a huge delay in the plutonium thermal loading in Japan. So another cover-up I want to mention here in the United States is Davis-Besse, Ohio, which had a massive corrosion hole in the lid of the reactor in 2002 and operated to within 3/16 of an inch of breaching the lid through nearly 7 inches of carbon steel. And again, cover-ups. Video footage was edited before the NRC was allowed to see it. This photograph, though, the NRC had in its possession, still did not take action. This is a lava stream, so to speak, of boric acid crystals and rust coming off of the lid. And the former NRC chairman, Richard Meserve, his fingerprints are all over this near disaster. Junior inspectors at NRC wanted to shut the plant down, inspect, see what was going on. Meserve and other senior management at NRC allowed the reactor to operate to the brink of disaster. And the Office of Inspector General at NRC later reported that NRC had prioritized company profits over public safety. Meserve resigned shortly after that report, and unfortunately is still brought to Tokyo, as in December, for consultation on nuclear safety matters. He also is the chairman of all things nuclear at the National Academy of Science, even though he serves on two for-profit nuclear utility corporate boards, Pacific Gas and Electric in California and Comanche in Texas. And through grassroots activism, was forced to recuse himself from the current radiation study on cancer incidents associated with nuclear power plants in the United States. So more examples of the close parallels between the U.S. and Japan. There have been not radioactive, but steam accidents where workers have been killed. So at Mihama, Unit 3 in Fukui, again, four workers were killed after a steam explosion. The subsequent investigation revealed a significant lack of systematic inspections at Japanese nuclear power plants. Surrey in Virginia, which David Lochbaum mentioned yesterday may have cleaned up its act a bit after two separate steam fatality accidents. One killed two workers in 1972. Another one killed four workers in 1986, and that's the single largest loss of life at nuclear power plant in the United States. Surrey's also infamous because they're experimenting with dry cask storage out there. They have a real smorgasbord of different cask models, and they've had problems. They've had leaks of the inerting heat transfer gas out of one seal, perhaps out of a second seal. It hasn't leaked completely out, but if it does, oxygen can get in, the waste can overheat, and you can have corrosion of deterioration of the fuel inside. So this slide is about radioactive steam releases. Now, these are not scalding people to death, but they do contain radioactivity that then leaves the site. Daiichi had such an incident in 2006. A really controversial one was the January 2012 steam release from a failed steam generator tube at San Onofre in Southern California. The two units at San Onofre are still shut down 14 months now due to a faulty design and fabrication of steam generator replacements, which cost $617 million. And for details on that, Arnie Gunderson is the expert witness for Friends of the Earth on this matter, and hopefully those reactors will never start up again. There's a groundswell of anti-nuclear activism in Southern California to keep them shut down. So earthquake risks. Before Daiichi, there was the 2007 quake, ironically on the Trinity atomic blast anniversary at Kajiwazaki Kariwa, which is the largest nuclear power plant in the world, seven large-scale reactors, some of which had begun to come back to service, but then the 2011 earthquake catastrophe, of course, has shut down all operable reactors in Japan except for two in Fukui Prefecture at the Oi nuclear power plant. Earthquake risks at Indian Point. Indian Point happens to be located immediately adjacent to earthquake faults that were not known about when it was constructed. And seismologists at Columbia University confirmed their existence in 2008, and the NRC has been forced to admit that this is probably the most vulnerable nuclear power plant in the country to earthquake risks because it wasn't built that well. Granted, Diablo Canyon and San Onofre are still vulnerable to earthquakes and tsunamis, but they were built more strongly because there was a recognition that San Andreas was right there. Indian Point, they had no such appreciation. And this image shows Indian Point in the distant background on the Hudson River, and Mrs. Sashiko Sato, a Fukushima organic farmer, Eileen Miyoko Smith from Green Action, and also an organic farmer from Hokkaido and another leader of the anti-nuclear movement in Hokkaido. We went up to visit the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition folks. That was September 2012. So this is just the cover of the New Yorker, another haunting image from March of 2011 that was published on the date of the Three Mile Island anniversary, actually, March 28th. And so I just wanted to go to some additional risks that weren't mentioned in that AP article from March of 2011 in Japan and their parallels in the U.S. Reactor pressure vessel embrittlement. The neutron bombardment of the 8-inch or so metal walls of a reactor pressure vessel over years and decades, and the impurities in the metal creating cracks which can line up, and if the emergency core cooling systems are ever activated, the final line of defense to prevent a meltdown, the thermal shock of the temperature decrease combined with the high pressure can crack these vessels. And if that happens, it would be an irreparable loss of coolant accident. There's no contingency in place. So the worst in Japan, the worst in the United States, another Entergy atomic reactor, just like Indian Point. Risks that have been mentioned are the high-level radioactive waste storage pools that are not located in radiological containment structures. Bob Alvarez talked about that much better than I can. We're having headlines about leaks at Hanford, and the irony of this is it harkens back 70 years, really, because Hanford generated the plutonium for the Nagasaki atomic bomb, continued to for the Cold War arsenal. Well, those high-level radioactive waste liquid and sludge storage tanks, the single-shelled ones, when they leak, it's directly into the environment. The first double shell had a leak in August. Granted, it's between the walls of the two shells, not out yet, but it shows there's problems. Leaks at high-level radioactive waste storage pools in the United States. There are are more than a half dozen pools in the U.S. that have documented leaks. Indian Point's pool leak is ongoing as we speak. Brookhaven's is very significant because millions of people drink the water in the aquifer under Long Island. So false solutions, a big fight that's coming our way, centralized interim storage. They want to put the waste onto the roads, the rails, the waterways, including the Hudson River. It's possibly targeted for 58 barge shipments of high-level radioactive waste from Indian Point down to the port of Jersey City. To get it to parking lot dumps, whether at a place like Savannah River Site on the right here, or Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in New Mexico, or Native American reservations out west. All for what? To create a shell game on the roads and rails and waterways, because if it goes to a parking lot dump for 50 years, it may have to go right back to where it came from for permanent disposal. It accomplishes nothing except transfer of liability onto the American taxpayer from the utilities that profited from the generation. I mentioned the good news at Kewaunee of shutdown. The only two reactors in Japan currently operating are these, OE, but the other 48 operable reactors in the country are not operating, and it's a real testament to the Japanese people and anti-nuclear movement. A lot of this has already been talked about by previous speakers. The 1972 warnings that the Mark I was a catastrophically flawed reactor. The GE3 blew the whistle in 1976. Also in 1986, the NRC's point man at Three Mile Island warned about the Mark I. So we have a campaign at Beyond Nuclear called Freeze Our Fukushimas. In the immediate aftermath of the Fukushima catastrophe beginning, we prioritize the Mark I's and Mark II's. If we can't shut these down for safety risks, then, you know, what can we shut down after Fukushima? The Japanese parliament identified collusion between regulator and industry as the root cause of the Fukushima catastrophe. We have collusion in spades in the United States between the nuclear power industry, and here are four of the five NRC commissioners. They are poised to pass a majority vote against putting filters on the vents at the Mark I's and Mark II's, bowing to pressure from industry and from House Republicans. So Gene Silp, who's a watchdog on Three Mile Island, a survivor of the accident, lives in Harrisburg, showed up in Michigan in 1999 with a banner that said, Three Mile Island, this is a Bob Deltradici photo, Chernobyl, and he said, where next? And of course, we have to add Fukushima to the list, and we again have to ask, where next? We have to shut them down before they melt down. Thank you.
What is Legal Shield? It's total access. It's total freedom. Everyone deserves legal protection, and now with Legal Shield, everyone can access it. No matter how traumatic, no matter how trivial, whatever your situation is, we are there to help. From real estate to divorce advice, identity theft, and beyond, we have your rights covered. With Legal Shield, you'll be able to talk to a dedicated, experienced attorney about whatever you want, as often as you want, for less than $20 a month. So no matter what happens, you're protected and empowered to worry less and live more. Visit www.cpdavisdarrell.legalshield.com. That's www.cpdavisdarrell.legalshield.com. Thanks so much.
Don't find that cesium gamma, it doesn't mean the food doesn't contain other radionuclides that are of concern, like strontium-90, plutonium-239. So obviously measuring food for just gamma has serious limitations, but it would be a reasonable start in any food testing program. Fukushima isn't the only source of cesium contamination. We have been being exposed to man-made radiation for generations from a number of different sources. So atomic bomb blasts worldwide, 954 petabecquerels. I will use quadrillion. And to give you an illustration of what a quadrillion is, if you have a quadrillion pennies on top of each other, they would reach the sun and back five times over. This is a big number. Every nuclear power reactor releases radionuclides to water and air as part of their operating plan. It doesn't take an accident to release this material, although we know they've had plenty of those as well. A total release amount for cesium-134 and 137 is currently unavailable and would have to be calculated for the U.S. nuclear power reactor fleet. It would also be based on questionable effluent release data that is most often collected by industry, not independent parties. Then there's Chernobyl. 85 quadrillion becquerels of cesium-137. This number has a margin of plus or minus 26 petabecquerels. So that's 26 quadrillion becquerels. Fukushima releases to air and ocean. Release of Nobel gas, unspecified as to what type it was. These numbers are from a TEPCO press release that came out earlier on. And finally, 10 million becquerels of cesium-134 and 137 are still, as far as I know, being released every hour. Now, what these slides have shown us is that we don't have a good idea of just how much cesium has been released or continues to be released. Who's testing? So who's testing our food for man-made radioactivity? Vital Choice and Eden are private companies who pay to have their products tested. Berkeley Nuclear Department ran about 115 total samples. I think all of them were from California. Most were from 2011. FDA, EPA, and DOE have severely curtailed their monitoring since the initial days of the accident. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was thought to be watching something called the Kuroshio Current, which somebody mentioned yesterday in a presentation. And if the contamination reached this current, they would consider monitoring California coast seawater and sediment. But I don't think they're doing that yet, and I believe the contamination has reached this current, which is like a fast track to the California Pacific coast. These aren't the only universities and institutes that have done testing. But the testing has been limited, it needs more money to continue, and there has been complaining about lack of funding for this very important work. Current and past food testing programs have a number of shortcomings. Most samples are only tested for gamma-emitting radionuclides. Testing has been severely curtailed now, even though Fukushima is still spewing and the contamination is becoming entrenched. EPA was criticized by the Inspector General because 20% of its radiation monitors in the U.S. were out of service when the Fukushima catastrophe began. And a very important point, and I want everyone to hear this, sampling a piece of food every once in a while gives you no real idea of the scope of the contamination or the bioaccumulation and doesn't pinpoint any radiation hotspots that might exist. So in general, testing of U.S. foodstuffs is inadequate. The U.S. limit of 1,200 becquerels per kilogram of just cesium-134 and or 137 is way too high. And it isn't binding because the FDA can decide to act or not at any level of cesium contamination. So it's exactly like not having a standard at all. Japan, on the other hand, their limit is 100 becquerels per kilogram. Finally, release of info to the public is paltry, if at all. So what have they found so far? California kelp, iodine levels were significantly higher than before Fukushima. They didn't test it for cesium, and they should. They've asked for funding. I don't know if they've got it. I don't know an update on this, but this is important because kelp provides a food source for fish. So there is concern that contamination from the fish that eat the kelp will be concentrated within the fish. Pistachios grown in California were shipped to a Japanese supermarket. The Japanese supermarket tested 18 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-134 and 137. Beef raised in Japan was tested and approved for market sale and then recalled, but not before it was fed to Japanese school children. All of this beef could have been sold to the U.S., and the FDA may not have pulled it. California grass, 14 becquerel per kilogram, cesium-134 and 137. Grass, like kelp, is the beginning of a potential biomagnification chain which could concentrate cesium in cattle, for instance. And as Berkeley put it on their monitoring site, for understanding the time dependence of food chain results, the grass and soil is what to look at. Green tea, 162 kilograms of it shipped to France from Japan and rejected because of this level of contamination, 1,038. The U.S. recommendations would have accepted this. Bluefin tuna swam all the way across the Pacific and reached the California coast, retaining cesium 134 and 137. Canada's cesium limit is apparently 1,000 becquerels per kilogram of cesium. And news reports express concern that they will import very contaminated fish from Japan. It is a concern that the U.S. should also share. They were also concerned because contamination was higher in 2012 than it had been in 2011. And this fits with cesium's tendency to biomagnify, but we will have to stay tuned and we should keep measuring ocean fish from the Pacific for cesium. Because of the tendency to biomagnify, in general, we need more testing, and we need to think about how to test over a longer time frame, not just a few years. So how should we think about these contamination levels, and how low should we attempt to make cesium contamination in our food? Remember two things. There's no safe level of radiation. Every exposure does carry some risk, no matter how small. And two, cesium-134 and 137 did not exist in nature before we created and released them. This graph is from ICRP Report 111. ICRP stands for International Commission on Radiological Protection. They recommend how much exposure is okay for humans. Governments follow these recommendations when setting standards. This graph shows us even what are considered very small amounts of cesium when ingested routinely can build up to unexpected levels in the body. So it specifically shows that after about 3 years, ingesting 10 becquerels per day of cesium-137 can cause a buildup to over 1,400 becquerels total cesium-137 in your body. For a child who weighs about 30 kilograms, or about 66 pounds, this would be about 50 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-137 in them. And this number is important because in studies of post-Chernobyl Belarus, cardiac abnormalities, heart problems, developed in children whose bodies contain 10 to 30 becquerels per kilogram of cesium, irreversible myocardiopathologies develop at 50 becquerels per kilogram. Additional pathologies at these low levels can include hormone imbalances, angina, diabetes, and hypertension, which, by the way, are all sort of aging diseases as well. In addition to these diseases, as cesium passes out of your body, its radioactivity starts to damage your kidneys and your bladder, which in turn damages your body's ability to rid itself of the cesium. This could mean that your body could collect cesium more quickly than this graph currently shows, which means the total amount of cesium in your body would be higher over time than this graph shows from chronic ingestion. Why is the U.S. guideline so high? And how about Canada's? Well, it seems to be some sort of official policy to encourage people to accept increasingly radioactive food. Consider this quote also from ICRP Report 111. There may be situations where a sustainable agricultural economy is not possible without placing contaminated food on the market. As such, foods will be subject to market forces. This will necessitate an effective communication strategy to overcome the negative reactions from consumers outside the contaminated areas. So their plan consists not of informing the public that these contamination levels, what the contamination levels are, so that we can decide for ourselves what is and is not appropriate. It consists instead of convincing us that man-made radiation in small doses is not harmful. So what are we going to do about this? Well, Beyond Nuclear, in coalition with other groups that are part of the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, or FAN, are in the process of petitioning the Food and Drug Administration of the United States for a binding contamination limit of 5 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-134 and 137. We're also asking for testing of soils and other things. We are asking that the testing be widespread and that the data collected be recorded in a publicly available database, no matter what the cesium contamination level. A database of this information, if constructed properly, could inform research on cesium mobility, biomagnification in the environment, so it could have a broad usefulness, not just for consumers, but for research as well. If you want an easy-to-understand resource on this whole issue, Silence Deafening, Fukushima Fallout, A Mother's Response by Kimberly Roberson speaks to the urgent need for food monitoring, as radiation from nuclear power is now migrating to our homes and kitchens. And, of course, I'm with Beyond Nuclear. We have a newsletter. We're going to be having a public petition so that people can sign on this issue. We haven't got it up and running yet, but stick with our website, info@beyondnuclear.org, and you can request our weekly newsletter. So, concluding remarks. When I first started to collect information that would help me recommend a level for cesium contamination in food, and 5 becquerels per kilogram was being bandied about, I wondered if this limit and the testing, that testing most of our food supply, was somehow unreasonable. Through my research, I concluded no, for several reasons. Cesium concentrates or biomagnifies in the environment through natural processes, so diluting it won't save us ultimately. We have to track it and its movements. Historic and continuing cesium releases ensure that generations of humans have now been exposed to it. To what end? What is the damage that has already been done that we may not be able to see? And I'm thinking of multi-generational damage here. Belarus studies show damage at very low levels in children, and ICRP admits that even small amounts of cesium can bioaccumulate in our bodies to this level. There's a lack of publicly available info on cesium levels in food, and we have no reliable estimate on how much has been or is being released. And then finally, they are attempting to convince us everything is fine, despite all that we and they still don't know and all of the uncertainties. And what we do know and what we've seen here in this conference is very, very worrisome. So it isn't just a question anymore of which catastrophe or routine release is to blame for what cesium contamination or any contamination. It's a question of the totality of the radioactive contamination and the damage occurring from it across generations. And cesium is only one of very many radioactive isotopes released. So looking at this evidence, I am now thinking that 5 becquerels per kilogram might still ultimately be too high, but it is a good start to get a handle on what is contaminated, what isn't, and how we move forward. Thank you.
My name is Mary Olson. I work for Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and I live in the southeastern United States as a field staff member of that national organization, www.nirs.org. And I wanted to include that website because on the day of the catastrophe, which was the day of the, I guess they backed down from 10.0 to 9.8 on the Richter scale, only one earthquake on Earth in recorded history exceeds what happened off the shore of Fukushima, which is in Chile, in the early 70s. I don't remember the exact date, but there, in modern times, this ranks as number 2 in terms of a seismic event. Off the Fukushima prefecture, where there are multiple nuclear power plant sites, all of which were impacted heavily by both the quake and the subsequent tsunami wave, which was enormous, 124-foot crest of that wave. I have not heard, even in conjecture, whether the rising tides of our planet due to climate change and warming of the oceans may have elevated that tsunami. I think that will be for later analysis, but I think you know, it's not impossible to tie all of these issues together as being related. The reactors came online in 1970, the first ones, and it's been a source of a little bit of forgiveness, a little bit of understanding, a little bit of compassion nested into this horrible feeling of outrage that I have about this event. To remember that in 1970 I was a young college student and I took a class on radical theories. There were three radical theories presented. One was greenhouse gas climate impacts. One was major meteor planeted type large object impacts, like what brought the dinosaurs down, we now understand. In 1970, those two were radical theories. And the third radical theory was continental drift. We didn't even have the words plate tectonics yet in the year that these nuclear power plants came online. So it helps me a little bit to be forgiving of the people who made these decisions to put nuclear power plants in this incredibly seismic zone, that it was a failure of reevaluation, that they didn't go back and reapply the new sciences to the old decisions and say, oh, golly gee, bad idea. The owners of the site have admitted that the earthquake damaged the reactors at Fukushima. There are six reactors there, but three of them had the fuel taken out. Two of them, more than a month before, the fuel was transferred to fuel pools, and they have actually made it relatively okay. There has been some problems, but as far as we know, that fuel is intact. That's Unit 6 and 5. Unit 4 had only been defueled the week before. They do maintenance and other operations. They take all the fuel out, put it in the pool. These particular reactors are GE Mark I, designed by General Electric, built primarily in conjunction with the Japanese in the post-reconstruction period of Japan under military control of the United States during the 20 years that it took to build those reactors. So there are six there. They were refueling number four. The very hot fuel was taken out just the week before. It was in the fuel pool. And these General Electric reactors have their fuel pool at five stories high in the air above the reactor vessel, which is this incredibly robust steel and concrete structure down below. So, shake, rattle, and roll, 10.0, 9.8, whatever it was, comes through. Enormous amount of plumbing in these facilities. You have to lay every little pipe and tube end to end. You can cover from one coast of the United States to the other with how much plumbing is in these facilities. So you can imagine all that shaking and rattling, that pipes and other things. We now know that at least one of the containments and one of the fuel pools were cracked by the actual earthquake. So they were in trouble already. And then 20 minutes later, you know, a tsunami, first the sea recedes, and then it comes back in full force. It's very possible that they lost cooling during the recession of the sea, but we don't know that. That's conjecture. And when the tsunami hit, it took out the off-site power. Most people would think that a power plant can power itself, that there would be the ability for the power plant to run the pumps that cool it, to run the control room that the operators use. But that's not how these things are designed. They're designed to rely on power coming into the site from off, you know, the grid. So the tsunami brings the grid down. There is at every reactor site backup power so that you can supply energy to run those pumps and run the control room. But that's run by diesel generators. And the tsunami engulfs the diesel generators and pulls their pumps out to sea. So the site now has zero power, no offsite power and no backup power. Today is the quake and the tsunami. Nuclear Information and Resource Service started a log. So if you ever want to like read the story in sort of blog style of what happened on each day, Michael Marriott, who's the executive director, somebody I've worked with for 20 years now, undertook to sift through all the information. Initially it was just a trickle of information, and pretty quickly it became this maelstrom of all these news reports and all these different TV things and this expert and that expert, and all this massive information was flowing out. And he sifted through that and sort of put together what was the sort of critical path information in his view. It's just one view, but it's useful, and it's a very strong record of what unfolded. And what basically unfolded is we now know that the containments of two of the reactors were breached. One of the fuel pools was cracked. The fuel in that pool was extremely hot because it had just been loaded out of the reactor core, so it was essentially a reactor core outside of containment from just 1 week earlier. So it was a very, very unprecedented situation. There have been a number of major reactor accidents. You've perhaps heard of Chernobyl, which was an explosion and fire in one unit. Three Mile Island was the melting of fuel in one unit that was far greater release than the government ever admitted to, but much smaller than this. There was a meltdown in Detroit that you probably never heard about at Fermi 1. There was a small meltdown in California and one on Long Island that you probably also never heard about, Santa Susana and at Brookhaven. In the 50s, there were massive accidents, one in Scotland where a reactor burned, a military commercial reactor, sort of hybrid there, burned, called Windscale. And in the same year, an enormous tank of radioactive waste that was liquid exploded in the former Soviet Union. And so it's been about every 10 years that there's been a catastrophe in the nuclear world. We skipped the 90s, and that's another story, but probably due to the preventive work of Union of Concerned Scientists and my organization, we managed to forestall one. But Fukushima is unprecedented. Four units in catastrophe. Conjecture now that the fuel is continuing to melt. That's not confirmed. But in any case, in units 1 and 2, the fuel has actually melted and dropped down into the bottom of containment. They're doing their best to keep liquid around it. Unit 3, there was a huge explosion. 1, 3, and 4 all exploded, but 3 was a much larger explosion. If you look at the high-resolution photographs, little drones have been sent over by, it's called Cryptome, and they're posting these very high-resolution pictures, photographs that were taken from unpersoned aircraft flying over, taking photographs. And you can see that Unit 3 is absolutely decimated compared to 1 and 4. Half of the fuel pool, third to half, looks to be gone. The top of the reactor vessel looks to be gone. It's still conjecture at this juncture, but that a chemical explosion at that site compressed the fuel in the fuel pool, and that compression made a critical mass that lasted only for a fraction of a second, but long enough to detonate an actual nuclear explosion in Unit 3. It's a theory, not yet confirmed, but there's a lot of data that supports it. And if you actually look at the photographs of Unit 3 as it exploded, there was a red fireball that was not part of the other two, that were simply gray kind of flashes of white light and gray explosions. And in Unit 3, the fireball followed by black that actually makes a little mushroom cloud suggests that there was a relatively small fission explosion. And the other concern about that unit is that there have been fragments of this fuel, the very same fuel that we a little while ago talked about as the potential scenario for an accident transporting what we call highly radioactive waste, exact same fuel, was distributed in a several mile radius. And that, the only event during Fukushima that could have possibly done that so far is the explosion of the fuel pool of Unit Number 3. So they're not talking about that. There's not differentiation when they talk about the different reactor units in the news, in the various reports. They skip over 3. They just don't mention it. It's as if it didn't happen. But I truly believe that that is the source of most of what we're calling the hot particles. And a friend of mine, Marco Catalfin, is doing monitoring using devices that are very much like human lungs. In Tokyo. Tokyo is only about 120 miles away. The city is already very contaminated. It's millions and millions of people. I've forgotten what the exact population is, but it's all of our cities combined practically in terms of density of population. And that area is contaminated. So Marco has this thing going. He also is using air filters from automobiles to figure out what is traveling by air. And he says that they're getting like 10 hot particles a day in Tokyo. This was maybe a month ago, so I'm not sure what they're getting now. And 5 in Seattle. So this distribution of the hot particles that were part of these fuel rods is pretty important for people to know that these events are global. That it's, You know, clearly burning coal is creating global impact. Clearly the climate crisis is a global impact of burning coal. But Chernobyl has had global impact. Fukushima is having global impact. Dirty energy just plain has to be substituted. And when people say, oh, you're just anti-nuclear, I say, oh, no, I love nuclear power. I just like it 93 million miles away. Because the sun is really where this type of activity belongs. Otherwise, you know, we're stuck trying to, quote-unquote, control something that clearly is beyond our ability. Fukushima is being managed, but it continues to emit radioactivity because every time they put water in, the water either runs out, in which case it's ending up in the ocean or in tanks and then in the ocean, or it's boiling off, in which case radioactive steam is going daily into the air because every day they have to add more liquid. And there's conjecture going on, and I'm sorry to use that word, but I haven't seen anything validating the idea, and it may just be that there's a blackout right now of clear information. But if the melting fuel continues to melt through containers, it can actually do what we call the China syndrome. And that is where the molten fuel, which is approaching the temperatures in the sun, not quite, but, you know, hotter than anything else on the planet, cannot be contained by anything and gets itself down into the groundwater where it can cause flash steam explosions to occur. I looked at the webcam today. The facilities are still there, so we have not had, and there is a 24/7 webcam that TEPCO, the owner of the site, has put up, and it's somewhat reassuring to be able to look at those pictures and, you know, feel like there's some ability for the rest of the world to monitor what's happening, even just visually. But there are independent monitoring going on. I'm going to add one more little piece, and then I'm going to stop, take questions. And the little piece is that they put a 12-kilometer, about 10-mile evacuation zone up, and they have expanded it out further, but the problem is that the explosion of Unit 3 and the other types of emissions are not, they don't follow the rules of a radius. And so there's areas that have plume deposition that's hotter, that's even out to 60 miles. That people should be evacuated because the levels are so high. But they're not inside the official evacuation zone, so they get no benefit from the government or from any insurance company if they choose to leave. And children are being allowed, you know, they're saying it's okay to operate schools with children getting radiation doses in Japan at the same level that nuclear workers get when they go to work at nuclear power plants. And, of course, the parents are protesting, and they're trying to work to get this changed and those levels reduced. And government support for evacuation of anybody who's living in these highly contaminated areas. But what's happening in the meantime is that mothers and children are leaving, and fathers are having to stay continuing to work to be able to feed their families and pay bills and all that. And their houses.
To start, I would like to thank very much the colleagues who organized this meeting, in particular Dr. Helen Aldicott, and also the press for expressing their interest by being present. This presentation is a little bit out of the main type of presentations you have heard. And it's a little bit technically complicated, so forgive me if I over or under aim my explanations. For those who know the subject, it may be too simple, and for those who are not very much in the line of this kind of work, it may not be clear, so please look me up. In any event, this is to stress that this is not a first observation. This is the third analysis, and is the very first time after 10 years where we start letting some results out, because the issue is credibility. It's not the data, but it's the credibility of the data. For general, those who teach and have students or young researchers, I think the news releases by the WHO or the IAEA are masterpieces of language manipulation. So I would like to call your attention that IAEA now is basically behind WHO, so their declarations now are given to the young people in the name of the World Health Organization, to which they should trust. Because if they don't trust the World Health Organization, then how can they trust much else? So the last one was in February 28th. And notice the similarities and the little nuances that are different. And one of those that I will show, the 205 declaration, is that now low-dose radiation appears as an if. And also the 100 millisieverts, the 100 gold standard, now appears to be lower. But all of that is sort of a nuanced in. And if you read further, now reduction of exposure is important. While in 205, in Kiev, they said, the whole delegation told the Ukrainian government to cut off all the programs that minimized exposures to about 250,000 people. So I will start. This work required cooperation of many people, many more than I can mention, and you can find out what is this OmniNet in the web. And it involves international and Ukrainian colleagues. Now, here essentially is to point out that we have participants in the international group that are most of them focused on alcohol, because alcohol is a teratogen, and a teratogen is any cause, environmental cause, that can create malformations or developmental problems. And in Ukraine, alcohol is a fairly common universal teratogen. So if you don't take that into account, you're going to get confused with another universal teratogen, which is ionizing radiation. Among others, there are cultural anthropologists, mathematicians, people interested in statistics, nutrition, psychology, and so on. So we did what we could, and most of that is done pro bono, and if not pro bono, none of it is done connected with government or the nuclear power industry. I also want to tell you that data is data, and good data is good data, and the gold standard is this one. It's the Hiroshima Nagasaki studies by Dr. James Neal. And it's not only about cancer and cancer and cancer, it is also about congenital malformations. But I want to stress that these studies are not about teratogens. They are about gene mutations, which is completely different to what we are going to be talking about. I also want to point out that the radiation model, in our view, from Hiroshima and Nagasaki is irrelevant to the Chernobyl situation, because the ionizing radiation in Rivne is chronic, not acute. It's not a blast, but it's a continuous drip. It's not gamma or neutrons, but it's mainly beta type of radiation. It is not external, but it is inhaled or swallowed. And the people that were studied that then had children 2 years later in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, those parents were exposed to radiation, but their children that were conceived in a radiation-free environment. Nobody in his right mind went down to the hypocenter to conceive a child. All these people conceived children after Hiroshima, Nagasaki. So we referred to a release of IAEA in 2005, but actually the data was already done in 1995, and since then it has been pounding the same message. So one of our collaborators, not collaborators, contributor, was Dr. Anspaugh, who very kindly explained to me, because I didn't understand this process, of how this enormous committee came up with these things. And this is the release, more or less, in the shape of 10 years later, and notice a little bit of nuance difference. So it is sort of presumptuous to say you're not going to find something. So presumptions are a little bit a derogatory term. But in any event, it freezes, or at least it makes it very chilled environment to say, well, I want to take a look. So we convened a meeting exactly on the 5th anniversary of the Ukrainian independence. This is 1996, World Congress of Human Genetics, and we invite Dr. Anspaugh, we invite Dr. Neal, we talked to Dr. Joseph Warkany, who is the founder of teratology. By the way, that's his etching. It's called Hiroshima Shadows Without Men, and so on. And we decide to explore the possibility. Dr. Lazuk from Belarus, Dr. Barilak represented the Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. We got together in Rio de Janeiro. We put in, you know, a couple of sources of funding, and we decided to try. Well, as you know, there is a situation of power change. After Chernobyl, 5 years later, Ukraine decided to leave the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union collapses. There is a creation of a new government. There's a power struggle between points of view. And in that environment, we tried to start an international program based on international standards to establish a population registry of every child born and every child examined. And that started in 2000. Now, the terms Chernobyl you already know. Polisia is a region of Rivne. Polishchuks are the native people from Polisia. And Rivne is one of the 28 provinces of Ukraine. And we decided that we need to use international standards, so we said, okay, we're going to join the European Congenital Malformation Monitoring System, and we're going to make Ukraine a member of that system, and they are welcome to come and check the data. So we established teams across Ukraine, and slowly, to quickly accumulate data, we were doing population monitoring, still do, in more than one province. And here is the cloud, and there is Rivne, and on the north, the northern half of the province is called Polisia, and further north is the river Pripyat, which you have heard before. And we quickly notice that there is a departure of certain rates. And if you look at neural tube defects, Eurocat reports 10.2, we begin to see 18.5. And we notice anencephaly goes higher, and microcephaly is higher, and anophthalmia is higher. So it's a hypothesis. Let's then see what we can do. Let's put our very limited resources and crank it up. Then we realized that maybe we should concentrate on the dirtiest of the provinces. So we publish here and there, and we study Polish chooks, and we put something in human biology because the population isolate, and they may be inbred, and they look like Cajuns in Louisiana and so on. And here's the province. The northern half of the province geologically is different. It has no clay, virtually, no binders. So the radiation that fell, plus the index of transfer of that radiation to woods, to trees, to nutrients, to grass, is so much higher that, in effect, this is more contaminated than Zhytomyr, which is right next to Chernobyl. So this is the most contaminated area in Ukraine. And we also noticed that the northern three counties are of particular interest. They are the most isolated, and I will come back to that. And they have seasonal flooding, just like in Louisiana. And that gives legs to a lot of radiation. It can move. So it's an ecologic isolate, it's a population isolate. As an isolate, they marry each other. And it has the highest index of transfer of cesium from soil to plant. And they have to eat or die from hunger, because they can't go anywhere to buy food. They can't go anywhere to heat, or else they freeze, so they burn radioactive wood. So, to summarize, special population, special ecology, special radiation, well, we have a real niche, ideal for multidisciplinary long-term studies of health impacts of anything. So we are not after selling that radiation is the only problem. We don't want children with congenital malformations, whatever the cause. So after confirmation, we are now starting this sort of presentations. And I'm going only to talk about Polisia and Rivne, and only to talk about two or three anomalies, because as you know, there are 500 of them. And we did, at the same time, surveys to try to narrow down what could be the cause. But this is description. This is descriptive epidemiology, which is not designed to prove cause-effect. It is only designed to prove what's going on. So, we know that the neural tube defects in Polisia are the highest in Europe. And that's up to Eurocat to say no. They are funded by the European Union to do exactly that. We also know that microcephaly is the highest in Europe. And so is microphthalmia. Three anomalies that are known to be associated with either alcohol or with either or both ionizing radiation. But there are little differences. So naturally, we were very lucky to have one of the longest NIH-funded projects to detect early as possible, fetal alcohol syndromes before birth of these children. So, we start with teratogenic risks. Let's start with alcohol. That's where the money is, that's where the bank is, that's where the NIH pays for people to do, so we do. And we conclude that cannot be an explanation of what we see in Polisia. So we see a couple of thousand women at considerable effort, we screen them, and we demonstrate that actually in Polisia, these women that are pregnant drink much less, not much more, than the other women that live in different cities. Secondly, we look at where do we find FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, and we find many more elsewhere. So the rates are higher away from Polisia than in Polisia. So we now look at radiation. Well, we don't have money, we don't have expertise, you are the experts, we are just plain pediatricians. We are pedestrian pediatricians. So, but we know that radiation has legs, and they get mobilized regularly. The fires occur every summer. One kind of tree has 20 times as much radiation per kilogram than another kind of tree, so there's no point in generalizing. A burning pine is different from a burning willow. Different organisms. And we know that this averaging out doesn't tell you a thing. It's a trick, indeed, I agree. The averaging out tricks are not good enough for a mother of a child with a congenital malformation. And 76% of them heat and cook by burning wood and then take the ash and fertilize their little home garden. So they keep concentrating and concentrating. So actually the concentrations are higher now than they were 15 years ago. Because the bioconcentration takes time. And so the pregnant women do the easy task. They go and burn dried potato stems. The potato harvest is do or die. Potato is a central element of nutrition. And if you're old enough, sit home and burn radioactive wood and stay warm and cook potato pancakes. And you can go and get blintzes here in New York in the Carnegie Deli, and they're terrible, so don't order them. Just take a look at them. So what do? We collect these plants and look at what's in them. So if a woman can incorporate radiation, can a potato? I presume it can incorporate. So we look, and to our surprise, we find strontium. We don't believe it. We run it again. And there it is. So we have a ratio of how much cesium to strontium, but all the measures and all the public health is based on cesium. We ignore strontium, and strontium for a fetus is much more important than we believe, because potassium is everywhere, but strontium has to go to specialized enzymes and skeletons and teeth and dentin and all kinds of other things, and it's going to stay with that child until it dies. So it's going to be radiating the potassium, they'll be urinating it out, the cesium. But the strontium, once you got you, it stays where it is. Now, I'm not going to repeat that, but anyhow, we take a couple of thousand people, 20,000 people, 20,000 measurements of whole body counts. It's a little bit, a lot of work. And we find that 48% of women in those three counties are above what the Ministry of Health says is safe. So, here it is. Now, how sensitive is a fetus? Shall we compute a woman as an adult, although she is pregnant, or shall we focus on the sensitivity of the fetus? I don't know of a single citation, if you do, please give me, of what is the sensitivity of a fetus. We say a child has 3,800 becquerels upper limit, and an adult 11,453 and three quarters. But how much does the fetus have? So anyhow, so here we are stuck. We did not expect to find things. We simply followed the lead. And now we have microcephaly, not alcohol. It can be due to all kinds of things, from abracadabra to the moon to whatever have you. This is descriptive epidemiology. But also has to be logical. So let's check. Maybe we miss minor effects, minor reductions of the head size. Because we did a very strict definition of microcephaly of three standard deviations or less. Otherwise, you're not microcephalic. You can be very, very retarded and have epilepsy and have a very small head. But if it's not three standard deviations, we don't count you. But now let's do the other way. Let's measure all the heads. So this is a comparison of about 15,000 measurements at birth. And to our surprise, no difference in birth weights, but a statistically significant reduction of head size in those three counties. What are you going to do with that? This is subclinical, probably, I don't know. Probably these children, you won't distinguish them from anyone else. But it's known radiation effect on the nervous system. So let's look beyond Ukraine. Well, there are studies by very reputable epidemiologists. They were then working at the CDC, and they go to Hanford, and they do a first study, and they find neural tube defect elevations, and they dismiss it because of whatever reason. Good reasons, but nonetheless, they are good scientists, so they repeat the study. And they confirm the study. Different approach. And they dismiss it again fundamentally because it contradicts the Hiroshima-Nagasaki observations. Not because of the inherent flaw of the study, but it doesn't make sense in the context of the golden standard. But the golden standard had nothing to do with teratology. It had to do with heritable forms of microcephaly. These are environmentally induced microcephalies. It's not that the gene came in and said, don't make the brain. No, the genes were fine, but the radiation said, die and reduce your size. So it's comparing apples and pears. And then there is a study in Sellafield. an editor from a reputable journal one time said I misquoted it, and I said, you better read it again. Because these are very subtle paragraphs here and there, but nonetheless, the most common anomaly among the most common are neural tube defects, and there it is. But, you know, there were a lawsuit about leukemia clusters near Sellafield and so on. The atmosphere was very charged. This study was not repeated. Then Eurocat does two studies, but doesn't study anybody near Chernobyl. Okay, only Western Europe, way out there. And good, bad, or indifferent, they say that we don't see anything. This is the path of the radiation and circling around England. And when we compare the actual rates that Eurocat reports, to our surprise, yes, Policia region is the highest, but so is Northern England, Wales. And we can see the highest rate, the second highest rate, the third highest rate, and we keep finding these regions in Wales and Northern England. I don't report those data. Those regions
on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see?